Tonight on Coast to Coast, we will match up journalist and filmmaker James Fox with Tracy Torme, of course, who's also a writer and producer. Their latest work, 701, the movie. We will talk about that and the incredible UFO stories behind it in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Both James Fox and Tracy Torme have been on with me before. James, of course, began his journalism career early on as an assistant to his father, who was an expert writer. Together, they traveled on many magazine assignments. They interviewed Stephen Hawking, a legendary race car driver, Dan Gurney, and he was all over the place. And then James decided he wanted to start doing documentaries and films. He's been working for the Discovery Channel, Sci-Fi, TLC, National Geographic, History Channel. He was on the Larry King Show with me a few years back. Here's James Fox back on Coast to Coast. Hello, James. How are you?
Good evening. Great to be on the show.
I'm looking forward to this. Fascinating work.
I am, too.
Let's bring in Tracy, too. Tracy Torme, of course, screenwriter, producer, creator of a television show, as well as a showrunner for a number of programs. He was the protege of Gene Roddenberry. That's the Star Trek fame, of course. His credits include Saturday Night Live, Star Trek. And, of course, he's the son of the late great singer Mel Torme. Here he is back, Tracy Torme. Tracy, always a pleasure. How are you?
Thank you, George. It's great to talk to you again.
This is fun to get you both together. James, let's start a little bit. What have you been doing lately?
Well, you know, a few years ago, I felt like I fell short of my goal of producing a film for a theatrical release on the subject of UFOs that could be presented on a worldwide platform in theaters. And I worked very, very hard on the project, and I ended up selling it to A&E, and it would broadcast on History Channel. It's called I Know What I Saw. And, you know, as happy as I was about the accomplishment, I felt disappointed. And I remember being somewhat down at the time. My dad says, "Son, what's going on?" I said, "Oh, gosh, Dad, I didn't do it." He said, "Yeah, but look what you did do, you know." I said, "Yeah, but I really wanted to put this UFO documentary in theaters, you know." And so anyway, so fast forward a couple of years, Tracy Torme, out of the blue, contacts me. And Tracy, you could kind of take it over from there.
Well, you know, George, I had done a bunch of UFO projects and movies and TV, and I was kind of worried about getting typecast for doing that. So all of a sudden, everybody that was building a flying saucer in their garage was contacting me and wanting me to do something with their project. And I shied away from it for quite a while. Then I saw James' film, I Know What I Saw, and was really, really impressed by it. So I contacted him, and we both realized that we had one goal, that was to maybe do a UFO documentary for the feature world, because there'd certainly been a lot on television. Television had been saturated with this kind of thing. So we both realized we really wanted to do a movie and make sure that it really came out as a movie and not as a TV project. And that's where this started with 701.
And we're going to go through the various aspects of this movie. James, by the way, I got to ask you, I'm sure you, as I do, I miss Larry King. He was good for the field of ufology. And we've lost that on a national level.
You know, I went on his show. He's got a new show now. It's
it's on an internet base. Aura TV.
Yeah, exactly. Aura TV. Thank you. And I did one of those, I think, about 2 years ago. It was great to be back with him, but it just doesn't have the punch it once had.
No, or the reach.
Or the reach. Thank you. Or the budget.
Or the budget. But yeah, we've lost something there. We got to pick up the slack because, at least on a national level for television, he was really the only one out there doing this.
He really was. And I remember how exciting it was, giving pretty much free rein and having enough funding to, you know, organize satellite feeds from Europe and flying people in from all over the United States. It was just amazing. And the reach that Larry King Live had in CNN was just phenomenal. I mean, every time I did one of their shows, it was like everyone across the globe would contact me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need another one of him. That was fun, wasn't it?
Yep, it sure was. We had some great times. It was neat being on with Buzz Aldrin, second man to walk on the moon, as he was talking about his space capsule. Larry wanted to keep talking about, did you see a UFO? And Buzz didn't want to have anything to do with that, did he?
He really didn't. God, that was a frustrating moment.
It sure was. So let's get into, and let's start with you here, James, and then both of you jump in at any time. This documentary, this feature film, 701. Give me the premise of this, James.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of our partners, Ines Romero, we were all kind of brainstorming around the table, and we wanted to find a name that was, you know, indicative of the UFO phenomenon, but somewhat more ambiguous, you know. And so we were putting all these ideas aside, and she said, "God, well, what about 701? About 701? Wow, that's the number of cases that remained unexplained as part of Project Blue Book. They studied 12,618 cases from like 48 to 69, and out of those, 701 remained unexplained. And we really liked that, what it symbolized. And we always talk about this stubborn core 5 to 10% of UFO cases that simply cannot be explained in sort of down-to-earth conventional terms. And 701 is symbolic of those cases. And those are the cases that we're going after for this project.
Now, to some new people to the program, James, who are younger, they may not know what Project Blue Book was. Go ahead.
Good point. Okay, so it started off, the United States Air Force started off investigating UFOs. It started off as Project Grudge in 1947. Project Sign. Project Sign gave an estimate of the situation, which concluded flying saucers were real. They were probably interplanetary. I guess General Hoyt Vandenberg stomped that and said there wasn't sufficient evidence. And that turned into Project Grudge. And then I think it was in 48 or 49, that turned into Project Blue Book. And Blue Book lasted until 1969.
It's interesting, George. The original estimate of the situation written by the Air Force concluded that UFOs were almost certainly interplanetary in nature. Now, that shocks a lot of people to hear that that's the original finding of the Air Force, because the Air Force became so anti-UFO.
Right.
And it was supposedly burned. All copies of the estimate of the situation were burned, and you can't find one today. You can actually find a couple of people that actually did see it, but there are no copies in existence of it anymore, because it was completely rejected by the top of the Air Force, who said, we just don't go along with this. But fascinating that their first conclusion was that it was all real.
Yet they kind of buried that, didn't they, Tracy?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
That tells you
quite a lot.
I was sorry to interrupt you guys. I was just at the National Archives, and I was digging up Project Blue Book files, and I talked to Colonel William Coleman, who was public spokesperson for Project Blue Book for some time at the Pentagon. And I said, well, where did these files go? I want the original files. He said, well, I think an Air Force base in Alabama, or they could have gone here. And everyone had a slightly different idea of where they were. Long story short, we found some of the original Project Blue Book files, the National Archives in Maryland. And I came across documents talking about the estimate of the situation having been destroyed, and inquiries coming in from different members of the Air Force asking about trying to get their hands on a copy, and literally the Air Force saying it was literally destroyed. I think they shredded it or burned it or something. So, yeah.
And of course, Project Blue Book being, of course, the pet project of J. Allen Hynek at the time. He was the consultant to Project Blue Book, and, of course, was at the time publicly a skeptic, wasn't he, James?
Yeah, well, very much so, you know, but he slowly started to change his mind, and after he retired from the Air Force in 69, he founded GUFOS, Center for UFO Studies, and he became an advocate for, you know, further scientific research and the fact that, you know, we were probably, I think he went as far as to say we were probably not alone.
You know, George, it's interesting, too, that the person with the most knowledge of the subject, J. Allen Hynek, who started off as the biggest debunker of the subject, later became its biggest proponent. He created the term Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He worked with Spielberg on the movie. And he became a total advocate for the subject after initially being such a skeptic. And for people that think there's nothing to it, again, that's a hard one to explain.
That's true. I always remember him with that little clip in Close Encounters where he walked out with his pipe and just kind of like looked at this UFO. But you're right. I mean, he really became a staunch supporter. I have always wondered, Tracy and James, whether Hynek somehow really had inside information, and that's what helped change his mind. What do you think, James?
Well, there are certainly rumors to that effect, that he knew more than he ever really said. But he certainly had access to tremendous amounts of information that we don't have. What also, to get back to the 701 title for a moment, it's interesting that the Air Force admitted to 701 cases that they had no explanation for. But the fact is, in those days, if the Air Force said, oh, this sighting was the planet Venus, and then someone came up with the fact that Venus was on the other side of the Earth at that time and could not have been the object, the Air Force would still list it as explained. They wouldn't go in and change their diagnosis and say, okay, this is now an unexplained case. So when they admit to 701 unexplained cases, there must be far more than that, actually. It's actually a much smaller number than is honest.
Why did the Air Force seem to be so down on revealing anything about UFOs?
Well, you know, 1947 is a very key year in the subject, and it leads to an explanation for what you just asked. 1947, Kenneth Arnold, a private pilot, saw 9 objects flying over the Cascade Mountains of Washington, D.C. He said they looked like a saucer skipping across water. That's how they flew. And that's where the term flying saucer came from. And all of a sudden, flying saucers were in the headlines all across the country. They were just being seen everywhere. It's also when Roswell happened. Roswell happened only a few weeks after Kenneth Arnold's initial sighting. And the Air Force was really in a panic. They just didn't understand what these things were. They obviously showed a technology far advanced to our own. Suddenly, the most powerful Air Force in the world had to admit that they weren't in control of their own skies. So there came sort of a frantic attempt to explain them at all costs. And that's where it all started.
You know, it's very interesting. If we have time, I'll tell you quickly before we go to a commercial break.
Yeah, you've got time. Go ahead, James.
Okay, cool. I just got the privilege to interview Colonel William Coleman, who is public spokesperson for the Project Blue Book. Now, the interesting thing about him is in 1955, he was a pilot in World War II, and he was piloting, not in 1955, but in 1955, he was piloting a B-25, and I think he had 4 or 5 other passengers, engineers from Lockheed Martin and other Boeing, I think. And they had an incredible encounter with a flying saucer. And Colonel Coleman described it starting out at about 11,000 feet, and then he said he went to full continuous power chasing after this thing right down to treetop level. And they, at one point, he was fearful that he was actually going to come in contact with this object right at treetop level, so low to the ground, at full speed. I think he said he was doing about 345 knots. He had to take evasive action to move around this thing up close, saw what the skin of the craft looked like, the metal, the lack of portholes, the lack of any propulsion.
Lack of wings.
The engineers on board were just baffled by how was this thing possibly flying. He said he had to take evasive action. He had to lift up, pull the stick back, lift up high enough to avoid his wing dipping into the trees to get around this thing. And then he said he looked down, and it was going across a plowed field in Alabama, stirring up dust on either side of this disc, stirring up these little dust things, and then it shot off. But the interesting thing is they all took detailed reports. They all gave detailed reports when they landed. And this was in 1955. I mean, Project Blue Book was in full swing at that point. So when he was appointed project spokesman for Project Blue Book, the first thing he did was go to find his report. 5 reports. They were all amazingly synced. The guy that did the report said that it was unbelievable how beautifully synced every single one of their reports were about this incident. And guess what?
What happened?
There was no report in Project Blue Book files. So
nothing.
You know, it gives you some indication of like, and this came directly, this is an on-camera interview from the guy who was.
Jeez.
So, you know, he knew like some of the best close encounter, you know, with a flying saucer with 5 very qualified people on board. And then those detailed reports were somehow misplaced or slipped between the cracks, or who knows where those went. But this goes to show, I mean, there were some great cases that were made public and did stick with Project Blue Book, but a lot of the really good ones didn't.
How old is he now?
He's 90. I think he's 90.
Wow. And I guess still sharp as a tack, huh?
He was sharp as a tack, and the amazing thing was, is I said to him, I was like, why doesn't the Air Force come out with it? Why don't they just tell us the truth? And he said, well, James, you have to think of it this way. You know, we can't give a little information without giving, I mean, you can't just let a little bit out there, and you're going to open up a floodgate of inquiries, and we don't have the answers. We know they're real. We don't know why they're here, where they're coming from, what their agenda is, you know, so you can't admit just a little bit. So it's have to be categorical denial. That's what he told me. I would think that someone in his position would know these things, but that's what he told me.
What kind of theories did you throw out in the movie 701, James, about the UFO phenomenon?
Well, we're going to explore all theories. You know, we're going to explore the spiritual theory. There are some people like Dr. Richard Haynes, scientist at NASA, who talks about a more spiritual element to it. We're going to explore the interdimensional. We're going to explore the interplanetary. Pretty much all of the above. And the
time travel.
Yeah, time travel. And the objective is that is to get, you know, it's the delivery of the message. I mean, the credibility of the person delivering the message. So we're going to focus on very, very credible people to specifically talk about these different theories.
It's kind of far out, George, but imagine if these things are actually from our own future.
Well, that's a possibility. That's something that you really can't rule out. And then maybe these humanoid-looking creatures, the ones we always call the alien grays, they could either be robots we've sent back, or maybe we've gone through some deformity. Is that possible?
You know, when you're dealing with this kind of stuff, almost anything is possible, because the conclusion that we've come to in 701 is that is the big surprise. After all of these years, they still don't know. If you could get to people at the very top, you could see some amazing photographs and probably some amazing videos, maybe even some pieces of wreckage, but they don't know what these things are or why they're here or what they want. And that's the surprise.
And what a surprise it will be. Do you think government is afraid to tell us anything?
You know, I strongly believe that. I know that we're probably going to upset some people in the field, UFO field, and I'm not one to want to go about mudslinging, because I respect everyone's opinion and their research. But I think the likelihood of us getting more mainstream, credible Air Force military officers on board this project, if we maintain a fairly conservative position on this, I think that they're going to be more inclined to participate. We have some upcoming shoots that we're doing in Los Angeles next month, and it looks like we've got a very high-ranking 5-star general confirmed for the shoot. And I think that the likelihood of others of his stature participating, maintaining that, could be fairly high. In other words, we're giving them an out, saying, look, all right, we understand why you've held out all these years. You initially were going to release some information back in the early, late 40s. You didn't, after all these years, conclude where they come from, what they want, why they're here. You did conclude that they don't appear to be a threat, and perhaps provide them an out. So that's Tracy and I's position and the rest of the team's position. And we think it'll be an effective one.
We're going to get into more of your hypothesis on extraterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial, and so much more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With our two special guests tonight, James Fox, Tracy Torme, as we talk about their latest work, 701, the movie. Hey, by the way, Beyond Belief, it's our television show. Why don't you take advantage of it? You get to look at it, of course, 10 days free. Simply go to our website, beyondbelief.com, and fill out the information. You can also look at the past programs. I think there's a library now of 39 or 40 of them, so go take a look at that. BeyondBelief.com. James Fox with us, Tracy Torme. Tracy, how did you get involved in the sci-fi end of your work? the writing and the producing?
Well, there were two guys that were my sort of mentors when I was very young. Joe Stefano, who did The Outer Limits, was his creation, and he also wrote Psycho for Alfred Hitchcock. And Gene Roddenberry from Star Trek, they were both kind of like grandfather figures to me because they were a lot older than me. But they really showed me the ropes and took me under their wings. And I used to go for these incredible meandering rides with Gene Roddenberry on a golf cart at Paramount Studios, where he would call me at my office and say, hey, meet me in front of the building. And he'd come driving up in a golf cart, and I'd get in the golf cart with him. And he'd go for these long rides across to the shooting stage. And he would tell me all kinds of stories about the origins of Star Trek and the different struggles he's had in his life with the networks and things like that. So I think both of those guys had a tremendous influence on me and sort of led me into sort of science fiction-y areas.
That's great. James, I want to talk with you about a little clip that we've got from you, and that has to do with the Scirocco, New Mexico case, where the police officer, Lonnie Zamora, who's no longer with us, saw an incredible case. You want to go into that for us?
Well, you know, it's amazing because when Tracy and I first teamed up, you know, he said, gosh, you know, there's this case, it's a core New Mexico case, you know, the landing of the UFO that was witnessed by Officer Lonnie Zamora, April 24th, 1964. And I'd heard about it. I'd read a little bit about it. But to be honest with you, I didn't really make that much of an impression on me. And because of Tracy, I started to dig into it a bit more and research a bit more. And then there seemed to be some ambiguity about whether Lonnie Zamora saw coveralls, whether he saw actual aliens standing next to this craft. And I'll remind your listeners out there, it's basically what happened was in 1964, April 24th, there was a police officer in Socorro, New Mexico, in hot pursuit of a speeder going through the town of Socorro. He was in mid-pursuit when some sort of reflection, some fire in the sky caught, no pun intended, Tracy, caught his eye, and he followed. He stopped his pursuit of the speeder. He turned off on a dirt road, and he went to investigate, and he saw an egg-shaped object, white, with four landing pods, landing gear that was landed, and two occupants doing something on the outside of the craft that looked like children. Initially, he thought they were children. And then a vehicle had overturned, and he was going to get closer to help out, and he realized that wasn't a vehicle overturned, and it wasn't definitely not children. One of them looked up and saw him pulling up in the police car from just a couple hundred feet away and was startled and made a quick move, I guess, around the backside of the craft, and Lonnie drove a little closer, get a closer look, and he got out of the police car and he started to walk towards us, at which point he no longer had visual contact of the occupants, and then suddenly the object made a huge loud noise and lifted off to about 20 feet off the ground, at which point it went silent, and then it maneuvered very quietly and stealthily off in the distance and then shot off at a high rate of speed up into the sky. So anyway, so I started to research this case, and then eventually I went into the National Archives, and to my amazement, I went in with a gentleman named Ray Stanford, who wrote a book on the case. He was at the landing site, I think, 4 days after it happened with Dr. Hynek.
And that was way out in the desert, wasn't it?
Way out in the desert. He wrote a book. Well, it's not too far on the outskirts of town. He wrote a book called Socorro Saucer and a Pentagon Pantry. And he was one of the you know, first civilian guys out there investigating this case with Dr. Jalen Hynek. He's very adamant about, you know, that Lonnie had seen the occupants. And we went into the archives, and I had to literally drag him in with me. This was just in July. He said, look, we're not going to find anything new. I don't know why we're even bothering to do this. So we hit the jackpot, and we come across, it's a long story, I'm going to give you the short version. We come across the original Project Blue Book files with this case, and there were hundreds of documents. And there were diagrams drafted up by Captain Richard Holder, who was the uprange commander of White Sands. He was on the scene, I think, within an hour and a half, of the general area of the footprints, of the landing imprints, of the scorch marks, the distances between the landing pads. And so it clearly shows that the Air Force knew immediately that there was substantial evidence that corroborate the officer Lonnie Zamora's story about the fact that there were occupants, because they took plaster cast molds of the alien, of the so-called alien footprints. And so I just found these documents just mind-boggling, quite honestly. And so I was going through some of them, and I thought, well, why don't we, you know, even one of the photographs of the scorched, you know, brush.
Yeah.
And so I thought these would be of interest to you guys, and so I sent a couple of them over. So if anyone's listening and wants to go check them out, go to the homepage on Coast to Coast, and you can click on the link right there.
In addition to Zamora, there was a tourist witness out there as well, wasn't there?
There were up to 12 witnesses of the case. And the more you look into it, the more you realize. And, you know, the Air Force once again tried to play it down. There was a press conference with Dr. Jalen Hynek. Hynek said he was coming in on his own. I found all the documentation that he was not going in. He was actually sent over there by Quintanilla, who was head of Project Blue Book at the time. Quintanilla, I think they pronounced his name. Sorry. And then he gave a press conference. And, of course, you know, this went out on the wire. You know, the media went crazy with this story. The Air Force didn't have time to kind of shut it down. But they tried to play the whole alien thing down. They say that, you know, try to say that you just saw coveralls, you know. And so this whole thing started to really get
unraveled,
played down.
Yeah.
The whole
George,
thing.
Also, you mentioned Dr. Hynek.
You look at the documents, at the Blue Book files, it's just phenomenal what was going on. I mean, they were getting inquiries from the Office of the President. They were getting inquiries from members of Congress, from the media. The Air Force was scrambling to provide an explanation. This is all documented. And they're having they're saying that there's no aliens, and yet they're taking plaster casts of the alien footprints. They can't find anything behind that would explain the type of propulsion and what it did to the plants. And it turned the ground into glass in certain areas. So it's an absolutely phenomenal case. And
great case.
Every bit of the evidence substantiates Officer Lonnie Zamora's claims. So it's a rock-solid case, and it's one of the cases that turned Dr. Jalen Hynek kind of around during his investigation with Project Blue Book.
Tracy, go ahead. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say that you mentioned Dr. Hynek, and the Socorro case was the case that really changed his mind. He came out of the Socorro case and said, I really can't debunk this anymore because we've tried and tried and tried, and we cannot come up with any kind of logical explanation for this. You had a totally reliable witness in the police officer. You had physical evidence. The ground was burned where the object had been. There were pod marks from the object. There were footprints from the occupants. So, and also there were the tourists that you mentioned that drove into a gas station and said, boy, you have some strange things flying around here. There was something that looked like a big egg that almost took the top of our car off. So you had corroborating witnesses. So the case is just rock solid, and it's definitely one of the cases that we're going to really focus on in 701.
It was, I think, just as good as the Roswell case.
In many ways, it's even better. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Go ahead, James.
I was going to say there were two witnesses, Paul Kies and Larry Kratzner, reported the landing of the X-ray. So they actually witnessed it landing. There was a car full of witnesses that apparently the object flew over their car so low that they said it almost took their antenna off. And the interesting thing it was is that the Air Force, and this is clearly understood once you go into the Air Force files, the official files. The Air Force is saying, oh, it's just a single witness, and trying to downplay the whole thing. And then when you go into the Project Blue Book files, you see people saying, wait a minute, the Air Force is saying at the time that there's only one witness, and yet the very newspaper in Socorro, New Mexico, published articles on the 28th of April with other witnesses there. So how could the Air Force have possibly missed that? And there's, you know, so anyway, it was a multiple witness. But Lonnie Zamora, the police officer, is the only one that actually saw the occupants.
And, George, last but not least, there's the insignia, which I find really, really interesting, is that Lonnie Zamora saw a red insignia on the side of the craft, that there's been a lot of controversy about what that insignia was, because there was a drawing of it that was published, and later on it was claimed that the Air Force had asked Lonnie Zamora to change the insignia for various reasons I won't bore your audience with, but that the fact that an insignia was seen on the side of the craft is kind of an interesting thing. It's very rare.
And I'm convinced that these smaller craft were probably coming from a larger mothership around the planet.
Absolutely makes total sense.
You know, while we're on this really quickly, I'd like to mention that I've been investigating the case against Tracy's, or my better judgment, I guess, with Tracy. But I keep going back to the landing at Holloman Air Force Base. It's featured in a film called UFOs, Past, Present, or Future that was done by a guy named Alan Sandler and Bob Emenegger. And the interesting thing is that each time the case starts to get cold, I discover new evidence to suggest, because the Holloman Air Force Base is only a stone's throw from Socorro, New Mexico. So you have a landing in 1964, April 24th, 1964, that Lonnie Zamora, a police officer in the area, witnesses. Lots of other people witness it, either taking off or landing or flying. And then you have, right around that time, an article that was written by, I think, Corral Lorenzen with the APRO Bulletin, in which he talks about, I think it was in May, and if any of your listeners out there can find this article, I've been desperately trying to find it. I believe it's May of 1964, where she interviews a guy that was on Holloman Air Force Base as a camera tech. He apparently processed film of a UFO landing, and I believe the occupants getting out at Holloman Air Force Base. Now, I know this sounds outrageous, but the more I look into it, the more I'm starting to think that that film footage actually does exist. So if there's anybody out there that's listening that knows about this article in APRO, please, pretty please, with sugar on top, get in touch with us. You can get in touch with us on our website at 701themovie.com.
Zamora died a few years ago. James, did he recant anything or anything like that?
Well, Tracy and I we're planning a trip to Socorro, New Mexico. We just interviewed one or two people, actually, that are fairly familiar with the case, and they are doing some contact research right now, because his wife is still alive, and there are a couple of other witnesses in the area that knew him quite well that are still alive. So right now we're going to go out there and see what we can come up with, probably Tracy, in early November.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, George, is that everybody that knew Lonnie Zamora said he was about the most unimaginative guy ever. I mean, he literally was like the last guy in the world that anyone expected to
pick up. He was one of those straight cops.
Absolutely.
If he pulled you over for a ticket, he was no nonsense. You know, give me your license, give me your registration. He was one of those kind of guys, I bet.
Absolutely. He was famous for pulling speeders over. He was one of the top cops in that area, so... They say that he just was the last guy that would ever make up a story like this.
James, the reports of UFOs during the 60s and 70s always revolved around tripods that would come out of the craft and prop it up. We don't hear that anymore. It's almost like an older cell phone, isn't it?
That's, Lonnie Zamora case actually had four landing pods. I'm only going on people that I've actually talked to or the cases I've actually investigated, but there was the landing at Edwards Air Force Base in which Mercury astronaut Gordon Cooper told me there were three pods. There were also three pods, according to a witness I talked to, that landed at Holloman Air Force Base circa 1964. That had three pods. Get me started
on
that.
Why the design change over the years?
I have no idea. Tracy, you might be better qualified.
Now we're sleek and everything else. We don't have those pods.
We might be dealing with more than one source for these objects. They may be coming from more than one place, and could be as simple as the difference between a Chevy and a Ford.
Well, it could be. Let's get into some of the pros and cons of your extraterrestrial theories. James, let's start with you.
Well, I would say that it's one has to speculate, but certainly all possibilities are on the table. And I think that some very intelligent minds have put out some interesting theories about interdimensional or interplanetary or time travelers or spiritual or
demons, which
yeah, or or demons. Some of the more religious people tend to think it's demonic.
They do. Yeah.
I tend not to lean in that direction, but you know, I have to be honest with you, George. First of all, I'm having to speculate here, but I honestly think it could quite well be all of the above. It's an awfully big universe out there, and the more I learn about the subject, the more military officers I talk to, the more I realize I don't know. I'm absolutely convinced the phenomenon is real.
Oh, well, I am too.
Phenomenon. It affects its environment. It's picked up on radar photographically. It leaves residual case traces on the ground. It affects plant life. So I'm absolutely convinced it's not a hallucination. It doesn't appear to be have a terrestrial explanation in most cases. But I just don't know, you know?
One of the people that we're interviewing, George, is Ted Phillips. And all he specializes in is soil changes. That's where right. Objects have landed and have chemically altered the soil. I mean, so again, for some people who claim there's no physical evidence, that flies right in the face of that.
Must have been. Well, there's no question that something has been going on. I like to think of it as being visitations from other planetary systems.
You asked what the pros and the cons of the interplanetary theory were. And to be honest, the biggest con is the distance between the stars. The distance between stars is so great. And if you were to go in a straight line, it would take so long to travel from one star system to another that mainstream science basically has ruled that out and said that that can't be happening. But I suspect we're going to get around the universe in ways we haven't even begun to dream of, that it won't be in a straight line. But that's really what mainstream science would tell you, is that it's just the distances are too great, and that's the biggest con in the interplanetary theory.
I
addressed that very issue, Tracy. I interviewed a guy, Dr. Brian Green. He wrote a book called The Elegant Universe, and I had to kind of dance around the topic because he's quite mainstream. And I had to dance around the topic of UFOs, but I sort of phrased it in a way that, you know, would we have the vast distances of space, would there be limitations for possible space exploration because of those distances? And he said, well, you know, James, you don't have to think of it as going from point A to point B. Think of it more as folding the space-time fabric between the two points, like traveling through a wormhole.
Right. Dots
these are very intelligent minds that have given this a lot of thought, and it appears that that's certainly one possibility.
Yeah, that's how they're doing it. James, we're going to take this quick break. Both you and Tracy, just hold on. And their websites, of course, they've got many. They're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking primarily about their latest work, 701themovie.com. I'm George Norrie, and we shall be right back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.